I just wanted to add something to what Kathleen said. Thank you. Don't show any family jewels or anything. Okay. I started out as a high school teacher in Fresno. Thank you. Go Fresno, All-American City. All-American City, good place to raise your kids if you have air conditioning. And my sister started with Betty Friedan in New York to start the new feminist revolution, let's call it, in 1970. So I went there, single mother with kids, got a job in a school in the Southeast Bronx, which is called Fort Apache, the Bronx. I didn't know that. Tried to put my kids in public school in New York. You don't. Had to send them back to Fresno for a while. So I got into Bantam Books. It was on the 25th floor of 666 Fifth Avenue. We don't have buildings that tall in Fresno. Right? So I was in publicity. And the authors that I publicized, I'd heard of, like Barbara Cartland. You could get her on any show, any radio show at that time. Louis L'Amour, who I traveled with. He's like this tall. Well, he was then. And he was just the nicest guy and brilliant guy. And he could write anywhere. So our publicity stunt with People magazine, we put him in the middle of the freeway as soon as dawn went and blocked the freeway and took a picture of him. We had typewriters in those days, right? Sitting on the freeway with a typewriter with his knees really, and he's typing, he was writing, so he could write anywhere. So then I got a call because I had done some unusual kind of marketing for Houghton Mifflin in Boston, which is was a very, very, very conservative Boston place. So I come in, Italian from Fresno, like that. You know, girls were saying, you use your hands a lot when you talk. And so they had a book called Even Cowgirls Get the Blues by Tom Robbins. And I said, we got to do T-shirts. We got to do these in paperbacks. And the women are looking at me like, you spoke up. You spoke up. Women didn't do that in the 70s. Well, anyway. So then I got a call back to New York, and they wanted me in an editorial. They wanted to put me as an editor. I always had the editors up here on the flat, so I called my mother, Rose, in Fresno. I said, Mom, they want me to be an editor. And she said, Antoinette, if it's not something that needs special training, like brain surgery or car repair, you can do it. So here I am all these years later, 20 years in publishing, as an agent. I started in 1991 here in California. Parents were getting rather senior on that vineyard over there in Fresno. And I had a little place in Brentwood. And I started, and then I saw, as Kathleen said, I don't know, when you become an agent, you become popular right away. Everybody just calls you the garden club and the book club and the thing. And then they start sending all this stuff into you. And I realized that what Kathleen said is that in New York, the agents sent us their best stuff. And filtered. They are the filters. They are the gate people who let you in and get. So I said, I'd always been a teacher, right? Become a teacher and an agent. And that's to this day, still teaching. Still have my Tea with Tony. It's called workshops. We have Thousand Oaks on Saturdays, Ventura on Monday mornings, and in Santa Barbara on Sunday morning. Anyway, so today this is what we're going to learn. Notice how my voice got just a little shaky there? We're going to talk about the brain, the human brain, as it helps writers. Now, why my voice got shaky is my brain, which is what it's there for, said, run! Those people are going to kill you. They're all in front of you. It's called fight or flight. So I'm not nervous, but my brain made my voice nervous. Okay? So I want you to start writing these names of these books now. I'm going to give them to you because we might not get to it at the end. So what we're going to talk about today is Wired for Story. How many of you have this? Great. Great. We're going to tear this book apart today. All right? Wired for story means that the human brain has developed in such a way that we are story. We think in story. We talk in story. You know what happened to me today at the grocery store? And, okay, I'm at my desk, and I want to ask my boss for a raise. So I'm looking to the future, which is, you know, maybe tomorrow. I'm going to walk in. I'm going to dress real nice. He likes red. I'm going to wear red. I'm going to go ask my raise, but first I'll chat him up a little bit, and then ask, so that's story. That's story. All right. Let's go back to caveman days when it all started. The cavemen, or whatever they're called in those days, go out for the hunt. It was a good day for the hunt. They bring back a whole lot of good stuff to eat, probably animals, right? And they roast it over their fire, and they are real full, and then they reenact the hunt. And some people are the audience, and some people are the actors, and they're mesmerized. We crept up on the, whatever they called them in those days, right? And the lion turned around and scratched so-and-so, Ugg, whatever his name is. And they're just mesmerized. Let's cut to today, to you sitting here. Your brain. Pick up a book. Doesn't grab you like that. What do? You get bored. Put it down, all right? So we're going to talk about what the human brain craves in story, and you, the writer, must give them to keep them interested, to make them care. Let's start right now by me telling you the books to get. If you don't have Wired for Story by Lisa Cron, C-R-O-N, write that down, because I'm going to outline it for you, and then when you get it from Amazon real cheap, you can go through and you'll know which parts to go to first. All right? Wired for Story. Another one is, this is technique of writing. Self-editing for fiction writers by Rennie Brown, R-E-N-N-I, Brown with an E, and Dave King. My agency, my workshops, you can't even get in unless you have this book and this book, Stein on Writing. I won't take a client who hasn't owned this, who doesn't own this book. They get it fast, right? And I tell them to. So it's Stein on Writing, S-T-E-I-N, by Saul, S-O-L, Stein. Okay, those two. Wired for Story. Now she's just written another one, which we're not going to talk about. But after you read this, get it. It's called Story Genius by Lisa Cron, C-R-O-N. Now, this one is optional, but by Shelley Lonkoff. His name got mentioned today. I was his agent. And I team teach with him a lot. It's called The Fiction Writer's Handbook. Shelley Lonkoff, L-O-W-E-N-K-O-P-F, which means lion head. All right? The other thing I want you to write down is my email address. Little Italian lesson, Lo Popolo. Lo is the in Italian, and popolo is people. The people. So you know that family did not come from royalty. All right? All right, so it's L-O-P-O-P-O-L-O books at gmail.com. I want to hear from everybody because I want you to, I want to send you sheets that you need, lists.
It's on her email list.
Okay, we're going to send it around. Okay. You put yours down for me and take mine. You just learned a little Italian, too, in the way. Like, all right. Okay, so where was I? All right. Okay, so, oh, Fiction Writer's Handbook. What it is, it's every term you need to know about in writing. How many fiction writers? Pretty good, pretty good. How many memoir writers? Listen, memoir writers, you are writing narrative nonfiction. That's what you're writing. It's called narrative nonfiction, which means it's a story. And it's written with fiction techniques, which we'll talk about today. I'm going to give you fiction techniques. You've probably heard of some of them, like voice. We're going to go through what that is and what it means. Two, so that's A for act, action. Here's what I get a lot from writers. They use was and were for the verb. Thank you for shaking your head like that. Okay, was and were have no action. We all do it. You know what? We all do it. So if you email me, you'll get my habit word list. It's everybody. You will have some of your own. You can add to, like suddenly, it either happens or it doesn't happen in fiction. All right. Very. You're either beautiful or you're not beautiful. Very beautiful. You're unique. Are you very unique? You see what I mean? And then we will have, you know, I was a teacher, right? I taught middle grade and middle, what is it called? Sixth, seventh, and eighth. And then I taught high school. And I have flashcards, right? Because the kids are all, you know, what they're doing. So you, one picture, 1,000 words, right? All right. We're going to talk about dialogue. But first and foremost, because Kathleen is so crazy about this idea of wired for story, we're going to go through some of this. Now you take notes. Here we go. I'm going to tell you what a beat is. How many know what a beat is? All right. Explain to me what a beat is. No, behind you. The one with eating candy or whatever you're eating. Not sharing with me either. Okay. I'm sweating up there. All right. Yes. What's a beat? Come on. Stand up here. See, I'm sweating like a horse up here. All right.
It's something that changes.
Yes. All right. Lady in the front, you just said it. What did you say?
Well, it's beats come, like I was doing with movies.
Uh-huh.
Like when you look at a beat of a movie, mm-hmm. It's similar to what she says, there are changes, but there are also things that like help you to control the movement.
Mm-hmm. Stop. A beat is a building block of the plot.
Ooh.
What happens? What happens? Let's give you an example. What was it called? Fatal Attraction. Nice man, lawyer, meets an editor at a publishing house. Right away I knew they were off. She had a white suit on, white silk suit. You're an editor. You have pens in your hands. You have printed pages. You don't wear white to work. But going close, Warwick, because he takes a beat, a step. What did he do? And he changes everything, right? What did he do? Who saw the movie? He talks to her in the elevator. All right. Yeah. Remember they took tore their clothes off and she took him home to that horrible place on 14th Street with fires going because it's the meatpacking district, by the way. No, why she had an apartment there. Well, she was in publishing, right? Woman, all right. All right, he takes a beat and then things change. If you know the story, how many do not know the story of Fatal Attraction? What? You don't remember? You must have been sleepy. All right, yeah. She turns out to be crazy. Remember on Saturday Night Live, they had Kellyanne Conway, the girl playing, saying, "I won't be ignored." That was Glenn Close. He ignored her. He thought it was a one-night stand. She thought they were going to get married. She's going to leave his wife. And
oh, All I remember is the rabbit.
She was a bunny boiler. She was a bunny boiler for sure, yeah. Well, it's in this book. Wired for Story, by the way. It's in the book. All right. So, Beats. Two young boys are going to crash a party. They're going to crash a birthday party. Right? That's the beat. That's the setup. They go in because everybody's wearing masks. But what the people at the party don't know that these boys are from a rival family in Verona. All right? He has a girlfriend. Does everybody know that Romeo had a girlfriend? Rosemary.
Rosalind.
All right? And he sees, ta-da-da, Juliet. Life, everything changes, right? Everything changes. All right? Let's talk about plot here and story and all set up. Shakespeare was very smart because he made it very difficult for these two people to get together. Very difficult because they were from rival families. It's like being, you know, from I don't want to get into politics. Okay, all right. So in those days in Italy, because it wasn't a united country until Garibaldi came, it was city-states, and the top duke ran everything, and the top duke was in rivalry with another duke, the Montagues and Capulets, for who controlled the city. All right, so you don't get together. But they do, and they secretly get married. But then something happens. Juliet's going to pretend she's dead by this potion that the friar gave her. And then when Romeo comes, he'll wake her up. But the friar, it's stuck in somebody's house outside the walls because it's plague, and they shut him in. He's what's it called, quarantined. Romeo doesn't get the message, and we know the end, right? What if they lived happily ever after? All the energy in the story is gone. If they get together, I think that wedding yesterday, that's the peak right there for us for story. Well, we'll get a little excited when they have the first baby. All right. But once the couple find each other, the energy of the story kind of drops. So Romeo, Juliet, in a couple of years, divorced Romeo because he became too violent with the sword. Just made that up. All right, let's take that same story, Romeo and Juliet, okay? We got a girl over here in high school, just left Arizona. She's coming to, where is it raining all the time? Oregon or Seattle, wherever. And a boy over here, who's in high school too, who's probably looks 17 or 18, but he's really 99 years old because he's a vampire. Twilight, Romeo and Juliet with teeth. Okay. Can they get together? No, because if he makes love to her, he'll kill her and suck all her blood out of her. Okay, so they can't get together. They can't get together. That's where the energy comes in. That's where you guys, the readers, will turn the page. What's going to happen? So your promise is, as a writer, is to your reader is, I'm going to make you care so much you'll turn the page to see what happens. Right. Now, I'm going to read you something. And let's see if this happens to your brains, okay? You ready? Where is it? Okay. Now, when you pick up a book, this is called Writing Lessons by Sarah Grun. First book, first novel. You read this, right? That's why when I have my students say, well, wait, I have to set up the story and tell where they live and what the house looked. No, not today. You know why? We don't have attention spans. Your story has to start on the first page. All right, but I'm going to read this to you because you will have read this before I'm going to read what I'm reading to you, which is very short, by the way. All right, writing lessons. As a world-class equestrian and Olympic contender, Anne Marie Zimmer lived for the thrill of flight atop a strong, graceful animal. Then at 18, a tragic accident destroyed her riding career and Harry, her beloved and distinctly marked horse. Got that in your heads, right? All right, here we go. She's ready to do the jumps. If she and Harry win, they're in the Olympics. Okay? Here goes. Have patience with me, Jamie, and all you, because I read that before to you in the workshop. Okay. This is the trainer first speaking. Watch, it's first person, but watch, the trainer says, watch your pace going into the combination and don't let him rush you. Collect him sharply coming around the turn after the water jump, and if you get past the oxer, you're still clear. Hold him back and take it easy because you've already got it, even if you take a time fault. I nod and look across the arena at the judges because I know that already. We can take 8 faults and still tie for first. And if we get none or 4, we've done it and nobody else has hope. My trainer is still talking and I nod impatiently and just want to start because Harry and I are going to explode with the excitement of it all. And we're ready, we're ready. Oh, we're ready. Okay. Then I get the signal and I think it's time to go. Think it, that's all. And Harry goes. Walking forward so deep on the bit, his nose is pressed to his chest, and as we step into the arena, I can see our shadow on the ground and his tail on end like a flag. The man on the PA introduces us, Anne Marie Zimmer on Highland Harry, with a commanding lead and yada, 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 and no one's paying attention because they're staring at Harry. No gasps or murmurs this time. Not on day 3, but then someone goes and wrecks it because I hear some bastard man say, now there goes a horse of a different color. And I know from that one remark that he's missed days 1 and 2. And I hate him because I know he feels clever for the remark. I hear the whistle and press my calves against Harry and we're off. Harry shoots forward like a coiled spring, so compressed his haunches feel like they're right under me. I tighten my fingers. No, 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 Harry, not yet. I'll let you, but not yet. And his ears prick forward together with this time. And he says, all right, and gives me a collected canter that feels like a rocking horse, so high on the up and so low on the down. And we rock around the corner and approach that first jump. And he asks me, now? And I say, no. And he says, now? And I say, no. And then a stride later, I tell him he's about to ask again. And before he can, I say, yes. And he's off. And I don't have to do anything else. Won't have to do until we're over and on the other side. And then I'll just have to ask him again, and he'll do it because he loves me, and we're one. There's the flap, flap, flap of leather on leather, the heavy incalzando of hoofbeats, da-da-da, 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 and then a massive push, 100,000 compressed palms exploding forth before silence. We arc over the fence. The only parts of me in contact with anything are my calves and hands and the balls of my feet, although it looks like I'm lying on him. So forward am I and curved around his neck with my face alongside where his mane would be if it weren't braided into a row of nubby topknots. And then bang, we've landed. And as soon as his front hoofs make contact with the ground, I'm back in the saddle and we're headed toward the brick wall and it's perfect. And I can tell we're going to be clear because that's just the way it is. We're flying now and it's a wonder to me that we touch the ground at all because clearly we don't need to over 1, 2, 3 more fences. I lose remembrance of the order of it, but don't need to remember because I feel it. Looked at it until it became a part of my being. And here we are at the spread now where White Knight and Frito Misto both refuse, but not Harry, on and past to the water. And I'm letting him now, trusting him, and we're flying. I bring him in on the turn, just like Marjorie said, and now we're headed for the double oxer, only the combination left between us and the finish. And if we clear just one more, the ribbon is in the bag and we're off to the Rolex in Kentucky. And who knows, maybe the Olympics, because why not? Because anything and everything is possible. Let me, he says, and I say yes, because how can I not? And I feel the energy gather in his haunches, and the pow, he shoots us off the ground, and the crest of his neck rises toward me. And I thrust my hands forward to keep the reins light, and it's beautiful. I cast a glimpse of a few faces over the boards in the spectators' hands, and I know they're rooting for us, holding their breath, even Dan, who's out there always, although he's still mad about Roger. And the moment I feel Harry's hind hocks clear the top, I know we're done. We've done it. We've taken first place. And although we're still airborne, I'm rejoicing because we've done it and it can't be taken away. His front hooves come down and his neck stretches out and I allow my fingers to graze his coat in a secret caress. I move my hands back in anticipation of his mouth returning toward me, but it doesn't. Something's not right. Although I can't process this because the ground is coming at me as though his legs were sinking right through it. I'm confused because we clear the jump and I was paying attention to how his legs came down and I'm irked, not scared. And then I'm not feeling anything because there's an explosion as the ground smashes into me and then blackness. Did you take the ride with me?
Yeah.
Guess what I did to you? Your brain produced dopamine. All right? And you want to find out, right? You want to turn the page. First novel. But guess one? Guess which one made the success? Water for Elephants. That's Sarah Bruden. Okay. Yeah, it was her third novel. That's her first. That's her third. Yeah, because there's a sequel to this. Because there's a whole story that comes after that. Because what happens to Anne-Marie Zimmerman, right? And Harry. Horse, right? Okay, so I wired you. Your wires connected, but it's really the author who did it, right? That's what you have to do. You have to produce this. How you gonna do it? Right? It's not easy. I don't know how long she took to write this. What I hope for you, because of Wired for Story, the book you're all going to get, I bet, and is to make you really write a good first draft. It'll be the shitty first draft because first drafts are always shitty, but it won't be as shitty as if you didn't read this book and get it in your head, all right? You might be writing your fifth draft. And by the way, I did not make up that term. Anne Lamott uses in her book, Bird by Bird, which I hope everybody read, because you'll walk out being a writer after you read Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. All right, here's what we promised. Wired for Story, techniques to write what the human brain craves in stories. And here goes. All right. We're all busy people, no matter what we do. We feel we should be doing something else. So, how will your novel, narrative, nonfiction, or memoir, induce your reader to fall engrossed into your story and forget what's going on around them? We're busy. We've got our mind on a million things. Even if you're retired, they're the busiest people I've ever met. Oh, I gotta go to my silver sneakers class. I gotta pick up the grandchild. I got a family coming over. People are busy. But if you get a book, a novel, a story, or a memoir that does this to you with the dopamine, you're not gonna do the dishes. You're not going to go pick up the clothes at the cleaners because the book becomes your lover and you want to be with it all the time, right? That's what I hope you will all do. Right? Not easy. We're going to practice, and I hope it helps, but here we go. We're going to talk about neuroscience. Now, I'm not going to make it boring for you because it's boring for me by telling you all their names. They're all in the book. All right. Neuroscience writer says, nothing focuses the mind like surprise. So when we pick up a book, what our brains crave, what humans want and need is this. Something out of the ordinary is about to take place. This course will show you examples of how all this happens in recent novels, just read you one, not so recent novels, plus how this year's award-winning films and TV series succeeded in doing exactly that, and why you, the writer, must cause this to happen in the stories you want readers to buy and get lost in. You want them to buy your book. You want to get an advance of money from your publisher. And I want to get your 15%. I'm an agent, okay? So think of these people in the publishing houses. All right, we have self-publishing. Don't even talk to me. All right, you have a whole conference for that. Okay. I don't make any money when you self-publish, and most of you do not either. Okay. All right. So, but at least you have it for the family. All right. When you write a memoir, at least the kids, the grandkids, yeah, they're going to read it, right? Okay. All right. All right, so how many of you have binged on series on TV? I'm going to tell you that I binged on two different series about protagonists who kill people, and I'm rooting for them. Dexter and Barry. Does everybody know Barry? Okay. Bill Hader, right? What a guy. Right. You're all lucky because I had to wait a week for the eight different episodes. They're finished. So you can go on HBO, on demand, or on your computer. There's a secret way to get in. Borrow your, or just take your code for your provider, Cox or whoever it is, right? You have an ID and you have a password, and you can put your laptop in bed and watch everything, like binge, like, oh my God, it's 2:00 in the morning, right? What makes us do that? Because we have to know what happens. Are they going to catch Dexter? We don't want him to be caught. And he's a cold-blooded killer, but he only kills bad guys, right? Chops them up and throws them outside Miami there in the Pacific, right? Barry, this is not a spoiler, is a low-ranking, what do you call it? Thank you, hitman, all right? He's very depressed. Goes to California because he has to kill someone, and he falls in love with an acting class and acting. I'll stop right there. All right. We'll learn how the human brain becomes wired for story, and that through human brain development craves how stories must unfold to keep readers interested, to keep them binge reading, turning the page because they cannot not. We will discuss every element needed to make this happen. Read aloud from writing you bring to find out if your story can pull the reader to turn the page. I don't know if you brought any writing. I'll walk around and read a little bit, see if it fits this. And make us care. We will discuss every element needed to make this happen. Read aloud from writing you bring. If your story can pull the reader to turn that page, learn how your protagonist's quest, desire, and conscious desires must make us care. We'll go over essential techniques for writing engrossing fiction and how these techniques cross over to nonfiction, including memoir. Let's start with dialogue. Okay? All right. Get ready. Before, I hope this works, by the way, because I heard today that some things like sound don't work. Dialogue is not, write this down, conversation. Let's do conversation. This is conversation. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Tony.
How you doing?
Oh, I'm wonderful.
Are you really?
Everything's great.
Do you like my outfit?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I'll leave it to you in my will. All right, so here's dialogue in fiction, and I hope in memoir, too. Hi, Lisa.
They let you out?
God damn it, my sister told me not to come here. She says you're a real bitch.
Well, that's where how you get places in this world.
That's what you say. All right, so you see, right away, all right. So I'm going to show you a little clip with Tom Selleck and William Devane. Let me set it up a little bit. It's from the Jesse Stone series by Robert B. Parker. Remember Spencer for Hire? This is his other character, Jesse Stone. Now, Jesse is a cop in Paradise, somewhere in England, and he's depressed. And William Devane, who used to be a cop but got his degrees in psychotherapy, is his shrink. Okay, let's see if we go. Forgive us because we're going to kind of do this in a weird way.
Years, where you been?
Fighting crime.
I'll try not to get offended.
You broke the 200 bucks an hour barrier.
That's why I'm not seeing you.
It's a reason.
Not the reason.
You lit a cigarette and you're not smoking it.
I'm trying to quit.
So it's kind of a crutch.
I'm an addict, okay? It's a crutch. Kind of like having two drinks a night.
I'm not an addict.
Sure you are. Let's review.
Why should review before I got here?
I did. But now I'm going to review with you. Why is this so hard? Are you still having 2 drinks a night?
Yes.
Ever break your rule?
Couple of times.
Couple of times in 2 years?
More or less.
More?
Or less.
Last time we talked, you said that you were seeing someone.
I was.
You said you liked her.
I still do.
So you're still seeing her?
I am not.
Have you talked to your wife?
Ex-wife? I'm sure that's in there, and no, I have not talked to Jen.
But you wanted to.
Old habit. I used to talk to her every day.
So why'd you stop?
I ripped the phone out of the wall.
Why'd you rip the phone out of the wall?
Because it was pathetic.
So since you stopped talking to her, you've gotten drunk a couple of times.
No, I got drunk a couple of times since I stopped seeing you.
And why are you seeing me now?
Because I got drunk a couple of times since I stopped seeing you.
Hey, you are a subversive son of a bitch.
Nothing happens here.
You did too good a job cleaning up Dodge.
I lost my conscience.
That's definitely not in here. You lost your conscience. Is that kind of a feeling you got?
Yes.
And you're frightened.
I've been afraid of half the things I ever did.
But you're frightened now.
Yes.
Because?
Because I lost my conscience.
That's it.
Hang on, buddy. Get the...
Ooh, dark in
here. Let me fix this. Yeah, lights, please. Let me fix this over here. Here's
the scarf. Let me take one.
Oh, because your scarf keeps running on this.
I'm going to take one. Not much big. Can you get that? Okay. Questions? No questions? Charge dialogue. Was that charged?
Yes.
Starts out with dialogue, right? 2 years. Confrontation. Bam! I'll give you a clue to what the conscience was. It was his dog died. And his dog would look at him when Jesse would pour drink. And he'd look at the dog and say, what are you looking at? And the dog died. So that's his conscience. And he's in deep depression. Okay. If you want to see the whole thing, I can send you the link because my daughter works at Hallmark. And they bought Tom Selleck's series called Jesse Stone, which I think is about 9 movies, about an hour and a half each. Very Robert Parker-ish because... They have a lot of wit in it too, you know, like Spencer. That's why I want you to have my email because I got lots of stuff to give you that'll help, like the habit words, the 10 common mistakes first novels make, things like that. Editorial philosophy. All right. Okay, so now we're going to do some beats. So Lisa, we're going to do one more of these. Okay, so you want to get ready and I'll put this over there. This is called conflict. If you don't have conflict in your story, there's no change. The character has to change from the first time you meet them, character arc, to the last one. And they change in every chapter. Okay? We want change. Or we get bored. No one can stay the same. Romeo and Juliet, the dumb kids, died. Right? That changed a lot of things, right? All right. And it made us feel. The hardest thing for anybody to do in writing, I find, and with my writer students, is how do we express in words how the character feels? What's inside? You can't tell, you have to show. She was nervous is telling. Shaking You know how you sometimes in a restaurant and there's booths and someone's shaking their leg and you feel it in your booth? They're nervous. Their motor's running. It hasn't calmed down. That shows that person has got something going on, all right? Catch it in yourself, you know? All right, so you show. Now, you're going to love this one because it's very young, Jack Nicholson, and all he wants, what does your character want? All he wants is breakfast. In the diner. Okay? And he has his girlfriend, Ray, the waitress, who he isn't serious about. It's called Five Easy Pieces, the movie. And two girls, a couple of girls he picked up that are in the back seat, and they're all in the restaurant. Okay, here we go. Watch the arc of the story. What changes? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you.
Plain omelet, no potatoes, tomatoes instead, a cup of coffee and toast.
No substitution.
What do you mean, you don't have any tomatoes?
Only what's on the menu. You can have a number two, a plain omelet. It comes with cottage fries and rolls.
Yeah, I know what it comes with, but it's not what I want.
Well, I'll come back when you make up your mind.
Wait a minute. I have made up my mind. I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes on the plate, a cup of coffee, and a side order of wheat toast.
I'm sorry, we don't have any side orders of toast. That'll give you an English muffin or a coffee roll.
What do you mean you don't make side orders of toast? You make sandwiches, don't you?
Would you like to talk to the manager?
Hey, Mac.
Shut up. You've got bread. And a toaster of some kind?
I don't make the rules.
Okay, I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
And number two, chicken salad sandwich. All the butter, the lettuce, the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
You see that sign, sir? Yes, you all have to leave. I'm not taking any more of your smartness and sarcasm.
You see this sign?
Substitutions.
Lights.
Lights.
Yes. I guess it wasn't the same exact. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Hold the chicken. All right. All right. So you can get that piece, by the way, on YouTube. Because it's a famous scene. We use it a lot in writing dialogue and also how things change, right? They didn't get their breakfast. So, here's your main character, puppet. I'm doing puppets, right? Here's your main character. Here's his goal, breakfast. Or whatever it is your main character wants. What will they do to get it? How are they changed if they get it? How are they changed if they don't get it? So conflict creates change. All right? You got to have conflict. Here's the thing, what I find, and Lisa will back me up on this one. We create our characters in fiction, but we don't want to hurt them. That's what I hear. I've invented a phrase, break the seal. You've got to dig down in yourself, become a great actor or actress, and live that emotion and find the words to express it. We don't want to dig down deep. If you can't do it, don't write fiction. Don't even write a memoir. Because memoir has to have fiction techniques like dialogue. Daddy at the table. What did you do in school today? Oh, Dad, you always ask me the same question. You've got to have it. Okay. You can't remember exactly the words that happened, this memoir, right? It could happen. If they do the movie of your story, they're going to write dialogue. Because in that situation, we sort of anticipate something that happens to a family at dinner. By the way, nobody does that anymore. Not since Father Knows Best, right? When they all sat down to dinner. We don't have dinner anymore, mostly in this country. Because mom's working, whatever. Okay, so dialogue has to be charged. We know what beats are. They're the action that carries the story. So now, let's talk about voice. I'm not going to ask anybody to describe it. But I will have someone, read someone, who can do it very well. Voice is something, when you read, whether it's in the first person character or the third person intimate character, you know the voice. Because their voice will reach out to you, and that's why you'll read the book. All right? And that's why you'll pick up another book with that same character in it. All right, so let's talk about voice. Is voice coming from you?
No.
Thank you. No. It's coming from your character. Okay, you're Geppetto. With the puppets, right? Or you're an actress. Does everyone know who Elizabeth George is? Is she still alive? Kinley? The British one that we had on PBS for a long time. All right. And his partner, Barbara Havers, who was Cockney. So you always take two people who are totally opposite. Linley is from nobility. Barbara Havers is from the streets. She's educated, but she's Cockney. And you put them together because then there'll be a clash. You take Romeo from one feuding family and Juliet from the other family. You take Rosanna McCoy she falls in love with the Hatfield boy, and they are feuding. They are feuding families. They are shooting families, right? Take opposite. Rich, poor, white, black, Catholic, Jewish. Men and women. Women and women. All right, voice. Here's voice. You know it in your brain when you hear it. Now, when you write a character, you create a character, you're in love with this character. Have you created them from the bottom up? I mean, like an empty suit? Have you written your analysis for each character who's on stage, main characters? Have you written their biographies? How many have? 1, 2, 3. Okay. How do you know your characters then? Oh, I got it in my head. No. You have to write, and we'll get into that. We'll get into that, to outline or not to outline. All right? Here we go. This is Elizabeth George in her one book. By the way, she was from Orange County. She wrote about England, English, you know, Scotland Yard, and the English hate when Americans do that. They love her. They love her. She has a big house now. She used to teach what we used to call handicapped kids, special child, now we have other names for them, right, in Orange County. But she loved England, and she's still coming out with them. She's still coming out with Inspector Linley, and she has other characters too. All right. As there is point of view, so is there voice. Who is your character and why are they showing you the story? Why did you choose that person? What does that person want? What is their goal? What will they do to get it? What stands in their way? How are they changed when they have to do that? Because characters change. The world doesn't change. But characters change, and we change, all right? So, You got to have tude. Let's put that first, all right? So tude, she calls it. Voice, you got to have tude. The critical element to point of view is something called voice. You've already seen examples of it in the previous chapters, and I've been alluding to it. Now let me define it. Simply put, the narrative voice of your novel is the point of view character's defining way of speaking and thinking, not referring to your character style of dialogue, however. I'm referring to the tone that comes through the narrative itself when that point of view character's on stage, rendering a scene for the reader. If you've selected one of the single character viewpoints, then the voice is going to be the same throughout the novel. If you've selected one of the multiple character viewpoints, the voice will alter at each different point of view character's renders a scene. Know that the point of view character is not your voice, unless you are the character, which would be probably memoir, all right? Is that kind of clear? You got it? Okay. The logical question then is, where does voice come from if it's not your voice? The answer is, it comes from the character analysis you've created. If you've done your preliminary work assiduously, if you've designed a set of characters who spring to life for you as you read over their analysis, then as you highlight the most salient aspects of their personalities, their voices will emerge. What are their politics? What childhood diseases did he have or her? What did the mother have? Where did they come? Did they come over? Are you first generation? Third generation? You just came over on the boat? No. I've heard one guy say, my family came over on the boat after the Mayflower. Right after. Of course, his name was Smith. All right, so there's an attitude about being WASP. There's an attitude about being Italian. There's an attitude about being Jewish. All right? And there's an attitude about being a woman. And there's an attitude about being a senior woman. Boy, do I get attitude on that, all right? All right, went to a lecture. Do you know the meaning of ageism? It's prejudice against people of age. It's big in this country. All right, we're going to change all that, right? All right. Here's the biggest flaw that I see in fiction and even in nonfiction. All the characters sound alike. They all speak like the writer, as if they took Palmer penmanship when they were young. All right? You've got to create a voice, a way of speaking, so that you, the reader, knows who's speaking, even if you don't put an affirmation. What's an affirmation said? And by the way, since Hemingway, we use said, not muse, explode, fume. He coughed. Hello, he coughed. You can't cough hello. Hello, he smiled. Remember? Remember? You can't, all right? Don't get me started. Mused, he mused. Said. Why? Because it's invisible. It's invisible. And put it after the person's name, not before. Hello, said Simon. That's Dick and Jane. Hello, said mother. Hello, said father. Hello, said Dick and Jane. Put it afterwards. He said. Stronger. And everything I'm talking about makes everything stronger. Impact. Impact. That's why you don't want to use the habit words. It is a big habit word instead of a nice juicy noun. Was and were, be, being, am, are thuds in the mind of the reader, even if they don't know it. You use verbs with action that show action. Start collecting active verbs. Don't use walk. Everybody can walk unless they can't. All right, so he walked to the room. Boring, 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 right? Boring. We're going to try not to bore people, all right, the readers. Okay, now I'm going to... Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you about this book. So Write Away, W-R-I-T-E, by Elizabeth Gilbert. She really tells you about writing and her own experiences, including the day she couldn't get out of bed. Each chapter starts with something from her writer's journal. She had just published her first novel ever, got it published, got money for it, and got good reviews. And here's what she wrote. I received such an outstanding review for Deception on His Mind, her first, yesterday that it made me really nervous. Several reviewers have talked about the fact that they can't wait to read my novels and that they're a little scared before they read them that I won't be able to maintain the quality I had in them so far. Gee, she writes that, gee. They should be on this end of things if they're feeling scared. How can I continue to maintain the quality? It seems to me that the only way I can do it is to take my time to approach things with thought. Characters talk. Characters act. Characters do both simultaneously. Scene ends. In the most basic kinds of writing, dialogue serves the interests of moving the story forward. So remember, every piece of dialogue you write has to move the story forward. There's no extra dialogue like Lisa and I just did. Boring, that's conversations we haven't, because we wear masks, don't we? We don't say what we really think. And it's a good thing we don't, because somebody will deck us, you know, or punch us out or something like that. Okay, I hope you're also writing questions, because when we get to 11:30, we're going to start Q&A, and I hope you have a lot of questions. I hope I can answer them all, okay? All right, so now we're going to start on, finally, how to hook the reader, okay? We're going to go to the brain part, cognitive, and story. Different, very different. So, the first chapter is called How to Hook the Reader. Here's the cognitive secret. We think in story, which allows us to envision the future. But the story secret, the writer's secret, from the very first sentence, the reader must want to know what happens next. Now, let me read you something. John Irving says, try to put the whole story in your first sentence. Again, I turn to Elizabeth Gilbert. All right? Here's the first sentence. Now, I read this when it was published. Three or four, I don't know when I got it. By the way, what are you doing in the car? Oops, sorry. What are you doing in the car when you're driving? You're a writer? Listen to books. Listen to books. Don't listen to the news, please. Or the reality show that's going on. And ask Kathleen. She'll say, I have to listen to music. You know, okay. I'm not going to argue with her. Get Audible books. Get them free from the library. Get your card here, which I just did. And get your card, and you have a number on it. Go to override.com, and you get Audible books free on your phone.
It's called Overdrive.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Override.
Oh, thank you. Overdrive. All right.
That makes more sense.
It does. Because I have that command on my steering wheel, Overdrive. I never knew what it meant. Overdrive.com. But you have to have your library card number to sign up. And you just go on the app and they'll send it to you, and if it's too many out, you'll get it automatically when it's ready. I mean, I can't listen to all the books I have on my phone right now. And sometimes you have to wait to the new ones, you know. But that's what I learned. That's when I learned, because I used to have to drive from Brentwood to Fresno. Thank God there was a store in Torrance where then, in the 90s, you could rent the cassettes of novels. And I took that 99 and 5, like, because there's nothing there. You see a bunch of cows, you get excited, right? Okay. And I learned so much just listening to be able to do what I'm doing now. Also, I edited in my head because they do repetitions like crazy. Donna Tartt. Donna Tartt used so many ly adverbs that my dashboard has dents where I kicked it. She used, and if she couldn't find an adverb with ly adverb that she liked, she made one up. He walked creakily across. The next page. The other guy moves creakily. So, like, where was the editor? Well, guess what? Why is Donna... Don't start me on Donna Tartt. Okay. So, why is Donna Tartt's last novel? She won the Pulitzer Prize. Two authors that won the Pulitzer Prize. I don't even go... I go to National Book Award now because... even Renny Brown, that book I told you, Self-Editing for Fiction Writers, she said, I should have had that book. It was 800 pages. It's a 350-page book. Well, it was. Donna Tartt, because of her first book, and she only writes one book every 10 years, so The Goldfinch was her third, has it in her contract. You can't cut, delete, or edit. So we took the Greyhound bus, we the reader, with the main boy Theo, who, by the way, doesn't have a package. Okay. There's no sex in that boy, but he's supposed to fall in love. Anyway, he gets on the Greyhound bus in Las Vegas, and we go every stop with him. The dog gets half a sandwich. They discover, they're not going to find the dog. They find the dog, and the bus driver says, takes a vote among the passengers. Shall we keep it? Yes, we'll keep the dog. Okay, then we move on. So that would have been cut out on a... Don't take people on rides. Come on. Unless something happens. They go off a cliff, or a truck smashes them, or a deer hits the windshield and lands in the back seat and kills the two people in the back seat, which happens in Pennsylvania. Okay. All right, we're back to telling your story in one sentence. This verse, what came before he shot her. Joel Campbell, 11 years old at the time, began his descent towards murder with a bus ride. That's it. So some guy was running through running to get a plane. He had about 5 extra minutes. Goes in the bookstore in the airport, looks through the books, and buys this one because of that first line. It grabbed him. It's the whole story. We're going to find out who Joel is. We are going to find out who he shot. Take 600 pages, but we get there. And I remember listening to this in the car, and I was engrossed in the kid because I was that kid. I was in his head. The camera was in his head, not in the author's, like a movie. You know, movies on the outside. I was inside. And that's what you have to do with point of view and voice, is stay inside of the character's head. You can't come out and then talk about them from the outside. You can't do it anymore. Dickens could do it, but that was a long time ago, all right? How many are writing in omniscient? Good! Nobody! Wait, did I see a hand go up? No, okay. No. Challenge yourself. Who's your main character? In that person's head. If you have more, then don't head hop. Do we all know what head hopping is? Okay. Next chapter, get into the other person's head, and then we know. Capiche? Okay. Comprende? Yeah. By the way, it's in Wired for Story, and it goes into detail. Okay, but here it is. Joel Campbell, 11 years old at the time, began his descent toward murder with a bus ride. It goes on if you want to hear the rest. It was a newish bus, a single decker. It was numbered 70 on the London route that trundles along Duquesne Road in East Acton. Yeah, right. That's Thousand Oaks, right? Okay. All right. So here we go. How to hook the reader. Chapter 2 in this book, right? How to zero in on your point. Cognitive secret. When the brain focuses its full attention on something, it filters out all unnecessary information. I have a son that way. My son, John, John! Oh, hi, Mom. That kid can focus. All right. But the story secret for writers is to hold the brain's attention, that's the reader's, everything in the story must be there on a need-to-know basis. You want to always stick all the information right away. Hansel and Gretel, rate of revelation, breadcrumb, right? So that we keep going, the reader, right? I love this because it's from When Sally Met Harry. Remember? She does that fake orgasm, and then the woman goes, I'll have what she's having. And that was Ron, what's his name's mother, right? Okay. I'll feel what he's feeling is the chapter title. Cognitive secret. Emotion determines the meaning of everything. If we're not feeling, we're not conscious. Story secret. All story is emotion based. If we're not feeling, we're not reading. I mean, if we're not feeling, we put the book down. Okay? Story is about, okay, we talked about beats, and that's the plot. What happens? Story is how the characters react to what happened or what's happening and how they feel. And again, try to break that seal. Especially, you know, I'm not going to be sexist here, but I am, of course. It's hard for men because they're taught from little boys not to show their feelings. So how are they going to write about them? Boy, Flaubert did with Madame Bovary, and Tolstoy did with Anna Karenina. Those guys knew women. Because Flaubert used to say, je suis Madame Bovary. I am Madame Bovary. He just reversed it into a woman. Right. Okay. Here's what I want you to do. There's two assignments I'm going to give everybody. Stop yawning. Okay. I'm going to give two assignments to everybody. One is mark up your novels and memoirs with yellow marker highlighter gel because it won't go through the page when you get a feeling from that author. They made you feel something. Could be it touched something in your own life way back, but you felt something. You know how you feel sometimes when a song, the words come and the song comes and it reminds you and you go back? Monitor that, your feelings. Don't be afraid to mark up your book. You own them. The teacher's not going to get you. The nun's not going to get you, all right? Because you mark up your book. People still have that, you know. I can't mark. I said, but you own it. It's yours. You paid for it. The other thing, we're going to talk about interior monologue. Everybody know what that is, right? I want you, after this meeting, you're going home in your car, whatever you're going to do, when you're alone, monitor your own interior monologue. You don't speak in beautiful grammar. Holy crap, that guy's trying to cut me off. This is what's in your hair. Like, I'm going to get him. I'm going to get him. My father used to do that. With the kids in the car. He would drive up to look at the guy's face and in Italian say, "Uzza brut." No, ugly. Oh, it's a brut. He had to see. And then in the backseat going, oh, oh. Because, you know, two-lane roads, he's with an oncoming truck. But he had to see the guy's face. Oh, did that to me. Okay. What do you call yourself when you make a mistake? Dummy, yeah. I came up with one. I don't know where I got it. Must have been from when I was a kid. You dumb bunny. And then worse than that. Mostly stupid, 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 right? Like, oh my God. So monitor yourself because that's how you're going to write in your character's interior monologue. They aren't professors from Harvard. You don't have to impress us with your grammar. Stop using semicolons. Kurt Vonnegut says, if you use semicolons, it shows you went to college. How about using exclamation points for emotion? Like high school girls, when they write notes to each other, did you see that cute guy in biology? Form exclamation points, right? Guess what? It doesn't work in writing. You can't do this to the reader. Get it? Get it? So Fitzgerald himself says, when you use exclamation points the wrong way, it's like laughing at your own joke. So don't do it. Exclamations are for exclamations. Oh, crap. You know, words, wow. Holy moly. And for loud. If someone's speaking loud, you don't have to say, you don't have to write, come here, you kids, she shouted. It's come here, you kids, exclamation point, so we know she's shouting, okay? Do not crap up your writing with stage directions. Stage directions. He turned. He walked. He moved his hand here. He put his hand on his gun. Hey, he's not thinking that. You're thinking that from the outside. Stage directions tell. And I call them stage directions because, like in Barry, when they're on it, so Henry Winkler is the director, right? He goes, all right, move a little on your mark, all right. Show me, make a face. That's stage directions. Don't put that in. And please, raise your right hand. Everybody, right hand. Never use the word grimace. He grimaced. First of all, it's telling. Second is a stage direction. And third, a lot of people don't know what it means now. Right? It used to be in the books. I went to a boarding school in Burbank. Not a fancy one. We had to clean toilets inside. Right? The mothers, Mother Cabrini, all that. Okay. All of our books were from the 20s and 30s. And they had words like, oh, pshaw. Which we pronounce pshaw, but it's really shaw, I found out later. The P is silent. Or grimace. Yeah, loved a series of books, The Little Maid of North Carolina, The Little Maid of South Carolina. They put cornflour on their heads to make it more blonde and had to wear a bonnet. So if you went out without a bonnet, you were a bad girl. Anyway, that's my boarding school story. Okay, so here we go. All story is emotion-based. Write that backwards on your forehead so when you look in the mirror, you see it, all right? What does your protagonist really want? The cognitive secret. Everything we do is goal-directed, and our biggest goal is figuring out everyone else's agenda, the better to achieve our own. Story secret. A protagonist without a clear goal has nothing to figure out and nowhere to go. Because I get this, what does your character want, Umberto? And Umberto says, he doesn't know what he wants. Don't bring it to me, and don't bring it to my workshop, because my writers will get you. Right, Jamie? Right. We had a new person in class. How many times, go over your writing now, it's on the number one on the habit word list. How many times do you use and start a sentence, and start a sentence with a gerund, walking into the room as I walked in through my same thing, you kill whatever's going to happen, the important thing, what's going to happen in the room, by putting that dependent clause first. You just suck out all the impact that you're trying to convey. All right. Digging up your protagonist's inner issue. Secret. We see the world not as it is, but as we believe it to be. All right. Story secret. You must know precisely when and why your protagonist's worldview was knocked out of alignment. You've got to be mean to your protagonist. You have to. Here's what the big writers say. Chase your main character up a tree, throw rocks at him. Ever read Michael Connelly's story about Harry Bosch? You don't? It's LAPD. Come on, you guys. Harry Bosch. You can get it free on Amazon Prime, the series, which is better than the books, by the way, for a change, right? Harry Bosch, the LAPD homicide detective, not only has the bad guys trying to kill him, he has his own boss trying to kick him out. Well, he did throw one of the officers out the window. That's all right. And three, the mayor hates him. He's got a 16-year-old daughter who walks into his beautiful house on Woodrow Wilson Drive, and she says, "Did you get a payoff? You say that to a good cop? He got the money because he sold a story to a TV series. And that's how he got the money for the pretty house that he has." But of course, the earthquake messes it up a little bit too. So I have a writer who says, "Well, I don't throw rocks when they're up a tree. I light a fire under the tree." Let's see how they're going to get out of it. Create something that your protagonist has to overcome and do and get there. St. George has to kill the dragon, right? All right. Here goes. Courting conflict, the agent of change. Oh, shit. All right. The brain is wired to stubbornly resist change, even good change. That's us, right? We don't like change. I tried to get my sister to use an electric toothbrush. She goes, "Why? Why should I do that?" Her name's Selma, by the way. Selma. All right. I got the Italian name. She got the Jewish name, Selma Jean. All right. So, because you cannot brush your teeth that many times as those little things, right? And it stimulates your gums and helps a lot, but you still have to use floss. Okay. All right. Stories about change. Rewrite that. Write it. Stories about change, which results from unavoidable conflict. Unavoidable conflict. Jack Nicholson could have avoided conflict, but then would we care about that scene? It would be boring as heck. All right. Stories about change, which results only from unavoidable conflict. Cause and effect. Secret. From birth, our brain's primary goal is to make causal connections. If this, then that. Story secret. A story follows a cause and effect trajectory from start to finish. Joel on the bus is going to shoot somebody. What can go wrong must go wrong. Cognitive secret. The brain uses stories to stimulate how we might navigate difficult situations in the future. Like, tomorrow I'm going to ask the mean boss for a raise. Okay? Story secret. A story's job is to put the protagonist through tests that even in the protagonist's wildest dreams, she or he thinks they can't pass. So challenge your protagonist. All right. How many are going to buy this book? Everybody, right? If you can't afford it, I'll buy it for you. How's that? Okay. All right, so question and answers. Because Kathleen just walked in, so she wants to keep it. I could go on, though. All right. All right, questions about your own writing. Come on. Yes?
As you were talking about the fact that your protagonists really need to write character analysis.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I didn't get that.
That's where the voice comes from.
Yeah.
And shoot, I went, might be a good idea for me to write a character analysis of myself in order to do a memoir.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, and your father and your mother, whoever the main characters are in yours, you know, like, what happened to father in his family? Did he lose his father when he was 3 years old or 5 years old? Anybody watching Patrick Melrose?
Yes.
Can you stand it? Oh my God, it's tough, right? Don't expect to be comfortable, because his father did something I can't even tell you about to him when he was 6 or 7 years old. You can guess, right? Okay. Another book about that too, The End of the World as We Know It, and that man at the end of the book tells you all the drugs he's on and how he finally stopped cutting himself. When you have childhood trauma, you pass it on to your kids. The Holocaust survivors who came to America, I don't know about the ones in Europe, and they pass that on. You have to be grateful that you didn't get killed in the camps, we got through. And so the kid walks around with this thing on their head. And Pat Conroy wrote a novel about it. What's it called? Beach Music, where it starts with a woman, about a 28-year-old woman, on the railing of a bridge. She's going to jump. And her husband, the narrator, is three cars because everybody stopped and he can't get to her. And this is what she's carrying, her parents' sorrows and horror. Okay? That's why when you do your analysis, you've got it. We don't... Okay, their looks is okay. The way they dress is important. But you're not going to put all this in this book. But you're going to know it in your head when you give them all those characteristics. All right? And all that they have to carry in their heads and shoulders. Your character, what they're going through. We people are come from English people. We speak English, right? You always put on a good face. I'm sorry, sir. I must have got my foot under yours. It's called subtext. We didn't even talk about subtext. Let me give you a real fast one. Because you make your dialogue sound all on the nose. Do you know what on the nose? I'll give you a really good example that was on TV before Easter. It's about Christ and Lazarus' sisters. Please, Lazarus has died. He's in the tomb. Lord, what can you do? And Jesus goes up to the tomb and says, Lazarus, come out. That's on the nose. I don't know who wrote that. Okay. So here, I'm going to give you a fast subtext. It's Macbeth. Don't get nervous because I make it funny. All right. So Mr. Macbeth comes in and he sees Mrs. Macbeth. And he says, I just talked to three witches who say, I'll be the next king. But we have a king. They said, I'll be the next king. And Mrs. Macbeth says, great, let's work toward it. Subtext. She doesn't say, oh, nice, dear, come and eat your gruel, or whatever. She says, all right. So they have to murder the king in order for Mr. Macbeth to become king. So she plans it, he plans it. And then he thinks of all the blood, and he comes to her, and he says, I can't do it, I can't do it. I already see the blood on my hands. She says, what kind of man did I marry? Okay? When he does it, he comes in. I don't know what she's doing, embroidery or something. All right. So he comes in and he goes, honey, I did it. She goes, my husband. That's Macbeth. So she doesn't say, oh, come sit down, have some tea, which is on the nose. Subtext is, we know what she's like. She's more ambitious than he is. And of course, she pays for it. Oh, no, some spot, blood on my hand. So that's subtext. All right. Any questions? Yes?
So do you have some suggestions on the type of questions you would ask yourself in doing the analysis of your parents?
Oh, yes, yes. All those things I said. What childhood diseases? What happened to his mother? You know, when she was a kid. So, because we pass that all on. Okay, what religion are they? What is their political proclivity? What kind of a personality? Is he bipolar?
You know? You become their analyst.
Yes, you do. Yes, good way to put it. You become their and what would they do in a situation? How is this person then going to take on this situation that is going to happen, because you wouldn't be reading the book if nothing happened, right? And how are they going to get the guts to do it? I hope that... You had a question back there?
I heard a long time ago in a screenwriting class that in the first 2 minutes, you have your whole theme and the whole film, just like you said the first sentence. If you could throw this question out, please. But how would you say there's a different focus for... fiction writing and screenwriting, because you're saying screenwriting is...
It's all dialogue. It's all dialogue. You only write dialogue and what's happening outside. So it's really omniscient. The camera's omniscient. It's showing you from the outside, but they have to show what's in their heads. Whereas when you're writing a novel, We, through interior monologue, are inside their heads. We are that person. That's why we read. We identify with this person. And if the author steps in, it takes us out of the, you know, and says, oh, well, he didn't like doing that. No, you can't. You stay out of, you, the author, stay out of your own story. I have effing in front of that. Stay out of your effing story. Don't let your voice be heard. First person, third person. No omniscient, or you're not really today kind of writers. You're taking it easy, and you're not challenging yourself. Miss Purple shirt in the back. Okay, yes, you have one. Mr. Fresno.
Yes, in reference to the omniscient character, you're talking about generally maybe the tradition today, perhaps. But we also have stories like, I think, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where you have a character that comes on, and you have kind of like a quirky character or a very unusual, unique character. We'll step into the action and we'll say, this is what's happening.
That's a movie. How would you do it in a novel? It has to be probably first person in Ferris Bueller's. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, all right? And you can't tell. You have to show. And that's why it's hard to write a novel. You guys are taking on, even in memoir, you have to have characters. Narrative nonfiction. The granddaddy of all narrative nonfiction is In Cold Blood. It's nonfiction. But we know the characters. We know the author who is a character, Truman Capote, right? He could not finish his book until they executed those two boys. And it took 5 years with the appeals. And he went nuts at the end. He never wrote again. Now, about, we won't say there are new rules or new whatever. Conventions change. Conventions change. We don't have the, what do you call it? Attention span. You get up here. All right. Attention span that we used to have in the 50s. I think it was 60s. When did answering machines come in? We ran home to see who loved us. Then the beepers, right? Now we have crazy people, look like crazy people, with Bluetooth going, blah, 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 down the street like this, right? We all hopefully turn our iPhones off before we came in here. I forgot. But anyway, we are distracted. So we have to now challenge ourselves to put the reader into the head. The camera is now in the head, coming out the eyes. Whatever they feel, the seven senses. Eight. Yeah, doubt, fear. Well, come on, you know. Spooks. Second sight. Anybody read the novel, The Red Sparrow? Red Sparrow? About the Russian girl? It was a movie that came and went because it bombed. But the book is good. And it's slightly omniscient, and I forgive him because he's so good. About a ballerina, beautiful ballerina, who was born seeing colors. So she can tell who's lying and how she became a ballerina is when she's a little girl, she tried to catch the colors. Like seven was yellow, eight, you know, like, and so she can read people. So it's a little bit of woo. They also put recipes for all the Russian food. The reason I bought the book is because James Comey, in an interview, and I watched everyone on his book tour, every interview on his book tour, said, when asked about Russia, if you want to know what Russia's like right now, read Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews. You cannot put it down. All right. Because guess what happens to the ballerina? Oh, I won't tell you. Okay. Other questions? Other questions? Yes, in the back.
Okay, you said that we have two pieces of homework.
Yes.
Mark with our
manuscripts
with highlights.
What's our interior monologue. Monitor your own interior monologue. Okay?
Not while driving.
Yes, while driving. Yes, while driving. Because it's going. Don't tell me you're blank.
No, I said you can get into an accident that way.
No, don't read while you're driving. That's what you don't want to do. Yes, sir.
Sorry, you mentioned one final book by Elizabeth.
George. Right away. W-R-I-T-E. right away. And by the way, I haven't gotten into half of the stuff I would like to tell you, and we're almost done. There's so many more things. I would like to do more dialogue with you. I would like to do just different scenes that scare the hell out of you in books. If you can scare someone, you can surprise them. Right? Okay. All right. All right. Yes. Well, we just did one. You want me to do it again? It's always charged. Each person has a different agenda. Now, in acting school, if you go take classes, they will choose two people, the instructor will choose two people, and they'll say to this one, you have a son who you want to get into this private school. You're the dean of this school, and you don't want this kid. Now get up there and improvise. So everything is, each person has a different agenda when they get together. Each scene, write this down, every scene, and scenes are the blood of your fiction writing and your memoir. Scenes have dialogue and or action in them, or action. All right, write this down. Every scene is either a negotiation, a seduction, or a fight. Now, seduction doesn't mean, well, we know what a seduction is, but how about I want to borrow your car and you don't want to let me borrow your car. And I work it so you finally give me that car to drive that day. That's a seduction. And by the way, Mike Nichols wrote that every scene, all right? Now, write this. Three letters, C, period, E, period, N. For each character, what kind of conscience do they have? If they are Mother Teresa, big, big C. I won't mention any president. Woodrow Wilson, sorry. Conscience, ego. Narcissists, and then there's pathological narcissists. You know that too. They do damage. The E would be huge. And needs. Needs. What do they need? Woodrow Wilson wanted everyone to love him and kiss his ring. I'm telling you a big lie. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. All right, so for your character, what kind of conscience do they have? What kind of ego do they have? This is your analysis. And what are their needs? What do they think they need? What is their misbelief? Go ahead.
How did you apply all of these for nonfiction, a memoir?
Father, so, your father?
Well, the
Papa, the character.
You have to find their needs or...
Yeah.
Mom
is born to serve. Mom was a person with little ego, always in the kitchen. You come home, she wants to give you. Here, honey, have some tea. Here's some cookies. I just baked the cookies. She keeps her own needs to herself. So the ones who have heart attacks, by the way. Okay. Not your mom, I heard. Okay. All right. Anything else? Yes. Jamie.
To outline, not to outline.
Okay. All right, here it is. No, 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 no. Where's my outline? All right, the outline. All right, the great outline debate. Many very successful authors swear the only way they can write is to jump in cold on page one, armed with nothing but the vaguest notion of what they're doing or where they're going. For them, the kick is to uncover the story as they write it. These are successful ones. They already know what they're doing. If they already figured it out, the thrill is gone and the actual writing feels redundant. But there's another school with members like Catherine Ann Porter, whose philosophy is like Edith Wharton's polar opposite. If I didn't know the end of the story, I wouldn't begin. Agatha Christie always knew her ending. Of course, she had to produce a mystery of a year, right? Okay. All right. Okay, here we go. The most common problem with stories that haven't been outlined is that they don't build. How can they? Without a premeditated destination based on the battle between the protagonist's inner issue and his long-standing desire, they wander, taking the scenic route to who knows what. You know how many people stop and describe the beach or the mountains? When I get that and I'm editing, I know they don't know where to go. We don't need to see the beach unless there's a body on it. Or a dead seal that we need to call the guy to parry it or something like that. It's a character. The beach is a character, or it isn't. It does something or it doesn't do it. All right, here we go. When the writer begins revising, something seminal needs to happen on about page 2. And once it does, everything that follows becomes largely irrelevant, which basically translates to what's known as page 1 rewrite. Think of it as pretty much starting from scratch. All right, have I convinced you to give outlining a chance? Good. But before visions of rigid Roman numerals outlines fill your head, or worse, the thought of plowing through one of those endless one-size-fit-all character questionnaires, which you'll find all over the internet, let me reassure you that outlining can be an intuitive, creative, and inspiring process, not to mention one that's often surprisingly shorter than you might think. Let's take a look at why. Myth. You can get to know your characters only by writing complete bios. Reality. Character bios should concentrate solely on information relevant to your story. This is page 90 of the book you're going to buy, right? All right. You don't put dumb stuff in like, does he like his middle name? What color evokes strong memories like that? No. It's much more than that. All right. And I told you, what are his political views? What is religious, if he has any views? How does he feel about women? How does he feel about his own mother? These are the things you want to know about each of your characters. Jamie's book has a mother you wouldn't wish on anybody, right? Worse than Woody Allen's mother, right? Who floated in the sky after she did, telling him, put on that sweater, it's cold, you know. does that help what I said? I don't know, okay. Anything else? Yes. Yes. Well, first person is intimate to that one person, right? So first person intimate or third person intimate. Harry Bosch is in third person, and I know him better than I know myself. Because I have never tried to find out too much about myself, and neither have you. Because if we knew as much about ourselves as we know our characters... You don't want to know all that stuff, right? But you have to know about your characters. You have to know who they are and where they came from and what they want. What's their goal? And Clint Eastwood made many movies like that, right? It's to get off his mule at the farm and has to go find the guy that killed his wife, you know, and leaves the kids to run the ranch and they're like this high. He has a goal, right? And things are going to happen. What can go wrong does go wrong. Don't use a mission, because if it's about everybody, then it's about nobody. And author, and also, who's talking to you? People used to think in the old days, Dickens' time, it was God, omniscient, speaking through the book. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Who's that? Who? It's the author. Geppetto says hi to the kids in the audience, right? I'm really the one talking, not this one. You don't want to ever show your hand that it's you writing the book, really. What else? Oh, one more. Okay.
That was like this in the Death of Artemio Cruz. First chapter, first person. Second chapter, second person. Third chapter, third person. Do you know any... well-known popular American.
He can do anything he wants. By the way, once you get published, like Nonatart, you can do anything you want. Stephen King could get the phone book, put his name on it, and people will buy it. They don't even get edited. Here's what happens, like J.K. Rowling, right? The last book about Harry Potter, she assumed that Bloomsbury, her editor Bloomsbury, would take her manuscript, edit it as usual, down to the size. So the editor, of course, wants to get, that's when we had hard copy, right? But the boss comes in and says, I'm taking it. We're publishing it exactly the way it is because they're going to buy it anyway. They were sleeping in sleeping bags all around the store. Remember that? Before we had digital and all that? So they knew if they did a book this fat, 800 pages, they could charge more for it too, and people would buy it. It isn't only streetwalkers who make money. Publishers, it's a business. So, but they had a repercussion. Josephine, her name is Jo Rollins, said, all right, you screwed me. I'm leaving this publishing house. Who wants me? And got grabbed by another house. Started writing like a guy, right? And nobody would buy it, and then they found out it was hers, and of course they bought it. You know, the mysteries, which used the man's name, Robert somebody, right? And that's how it goes in publishing. It's a business. Paper printing and binding costs a lot of money. Yes?
What's right for story? What is the author of that book you've been reading out, the Wired for Story. And it's the author is?
Lisa Cron, C-R-O-N.
C-R-O-N.
look at all the subjects I didn't get to here. There's so many. Yes?
What's her second book?
Yes, Story Genius is her new book. But read this one first. Don't jump into that second one. Right, Jamie? Yeah. Well, there's so much more in here than you have it in your head, right? All right. Anybody else? Okay. All right. Thank you. Oh, wait. Okay. All right. Oh, wait. I want my applause. Hold it. Okay.
Get it published, and after that, it's easier?
If you make money with your first book, if you bomb, change your name. All right, thank you, everybody. Thank you.